So my role and my pleasure this evening to introduce the speakers, and the first speaker for this evening is Heidi Thompson. Now, Heidi is an associate professor in the School of English, Film, Theatre and Media Studies, and she's a passionate advocate of the value of humanities and arts in today's society. And there's more about her in the notes that you've got. And so rather than telling you about that, I'd just like to introduce her, so she's got lots of time to talk to you about her passion and its importance to human flourishing. Thank you.
Kia ora. Thank you so much for having me. My expertise is bafflement, actually, and that is why I'm here. I've become increasingly baffled about the role of something I had been taking for granted for 35 years as a professional. Last year, I was chatting with Jan Rivers in her kitchen about the increased apparent need for a justification of the humanities in society, in the university, in our schools. And as these things go, I was waxing lyrical about attention spans and science taxonomies for humanities grounds and quantification over qualification. And Jan just stopped me and she said, maybe I should come and talk about this topic here. And so that is why I am here. I want to say right away, I have absolutely no ready solutions. Actually, I think the pressure to come up with ready solution is part of the problem, probably. So I have been teaching and studying humanities largely in its manifestation in English literature for 35 years. And I can't even, of course, scratch the surface in about 15 to 20 minutes. But what I valued in particular about my education and how I grew up was the opportunity to think and to read about a field, and I had the luxury to take that for granted for my entire lifespan so far. And one thing is for sure, that luxury is gone, because it was part of a vision that was grounded in, and more importantly, subsidized by tax-funded egalitarian welfare state, and in my case, that was Belgium. And many of you are probably aware of a book called The Spirit Level. Actually, there are two books with that title that I know of, and Susan may know the other one because she loves poetry, and one is a fantastic collection by Seamus Heaney, a 1996 poetry collection, which I warmly recommend. The other one is the book I thought about for this talk today. Its full title is The Spirit Level, Why Equality is Better for Everyone, published Penguin 2009 by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. So the bigger the gap between rich and poor, the worse everyone is off in terms of quality of life. Equitable societies fund many things that are not purely individually profit-driven. Things like good healthcare, education, retirement homes, cultural initiatives, libraries. So all of that happens through a kind of a shared vision that goes beyond individual profit. In order to prepare for this talk, I read that book a couple of years ago, but I also read two books by two very smart women, one by Martha Nussbaum, who is a philosophy and law professor, and she wrote a book called Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities, and the other book I read was Helen Small's book, The Value of the Humanities, and Helen Small is an alumna of Victoria University, and she's now a professor at Oxford and writes about a wide range of topics, including the humanities. So my own grounding, just sort of speaking from where is this coming from, is my own grounding in the humanities is rooted in Belgium, where I grew up and I got my first university degrees. And I'm definitely not saying that education system was perfect, far from it. It's contrary to what some people may think, actually. It was remarkably channeled. It focused largely on rote learning. The system was very authoritarian. It reveled in antiquated hierarchies. It was completely misogynist. But it was almost free. in a sense that accessible, largely accessible for all. And it also assumed that you could change your mind about a field of study if something didn't work out. It also assumed that any emphasis on quantity in research was irrelevant. And admittedly, while there wasn't necessarily much quality research either, there was something which is a little bit different. There was a decent amount of scholarship. So informed knowledge about a subject which my professors taught, as opposed to the kind of soundbite research we are now supposed to churn out around the PBRF clocks. And I know that some of you here had or have affiliations with Victoria. Well, when I started at Victoria in 1990, one of my loveliest colleagues was a man called Harry Orsman. Have you heard of him? He would be a complete zero in complete PBRF terms at the moment, because one dictionary? Hello? What else have you done? That's your first NRO. Where are the three other ones? This really is a very different environment now. The whole system that I grew up in, with its rather dismissive laissez-faire attitude to pedagogy, I mean, students were sort of, you know, also assumed actually, at some level, by default perhaps, that I could figure out what to do with my own time. So I did not have to meet bite-sized assignment standards, which are delineated and justified in increasingly smaller bites, thereby losing track of the overall picture. Instead, I had an opportunity, a funded opportunity, to relish reading widely, intuitively, in several languages. I never asked my professors if there was an abridged version of Crime and Punishment. I wouldn't have dared to. Neither did I ask if there was a movie. But I also didn't feel the urge. In a way, slow reading, like slow cooking, was part of life and of the humanities. And I'm not sort of waxing nostalgic about the good old days here. This is not the kind of vision of a distant land that was oh so much better. It was not, in many other ways was not, because when I was born, the Second World War had only been over for about 15 years, and I grew up entirely in a household where food, you know, was still a big deal. So it was not a charm, so to speak. So far from perfect, and at that stage, rather arrogantly confident about its permanent status of importance, a humanities education in Belgium offered something that was not entirely about assessment, quantifiable research, or, thirdly, vocational application, strictly vocational application. So fast forward from 1980s Belgium to 2017 Wellington, via 6 years in the United States, where accountability of the humanities was already an entirely different matter than in Belgium. You know, the idea of justifying what you're doing, or the cost of what you're doing, was already well established in the States by then. And I remember struggling with the report I had to write for Fulbright, which partly funded my studies. How was reading and writing about romantic poetry going to be useful? And you came up with an answer, you know, I was going to be a teacher, and all this reading and writing would be passed on, it would be great. And it was keen, enthusiastic, and that's great, but it was also quite inarticulate. And it's a kind of inarticulate kind of fervor that is no longer enough. And I've become very aware of that. So there's no doubt in 2017 in Wellington and beyond that the fate of the humanities has changed drastically. So what I did was kind of think about some of the issues, and that's all I really want to throw out. I would love to work more on this, like tomorrow or in another context as well, but I'll just sort of trash out what I came up with. So you can see there's a sort of neat CV there, and engagement which all involved teaching. I got diplomas in secondary teaching. When there were no jobs in secondary teaching, I got involved with adult literacy volunteering. So you became an instant social worker, kind of basically women's refuge person, teacher, childminder, all rolled into one. So it was very kind of educational experience until I went to the States, and there again I did teaching of writing courses, literature courses, and then I became a lecturer here. So, in terms of employment, when people now say, what do you teach? I say, I teach literacy, because I want to teach thinking critically, thinking imaginatively, creatively, being able to write about things, being able to express what matters. And when I looked up humanities in the OED, and I should have written that down, that it came from the OED, you know, source acknowledgement, what's very crucial about the definition of the humanities as we find it in a dictionary is that it has, as distinguished from the social sciences, a significant historical element usually. It talks about interpretation rather than the experimental and the quantitative. So I thought about that definition, and I thought some more about those three books that I had been reading, and I realized that dictionary definition gives you an illusion of timelessness. This is not going to change. This is permanent. This is what the humanities are. Yet, the reality in which we operate has changed so drastically, has changed so enormously at a range of levels, at the level of society, our political climate, economics, technology, communication, education. Every one of those could be sort of a soundbite to get a conversation going about how have the humanities been affected by this and how have they responded. I don't know, I'm not a specialist in economics at all. I gave Thomas Piketty's book a good shot. I read most of it, Capital. If anything, that book taught me that the welfare state that I grew up in and took for granted is the anomaly, is not the norm and has not been historically the norm. So that was useful. I also found out he relied a lot on Jane Austen to indicate, on the humanities, on a novelist, to indicate what value, particularly the difference between money and landed property, he illustrates that through novels. Balzac, of course, a great sociological resource as well, and Austen figure prominently. Instead of talking about economics, I've just called it problems related to money. Basically, a neoliberal ethos and the inequality that follows from that. And you only have to listen. I was telling Jan earlier when I came in that I listened to the debate between Macron and Le Pen. And boy, the choice is horrific, actually. When you think of what the need for adequate funding and the reality of a post-welfare state is a huge issue for the humanities. Because in this context, economic growth has taken on an increasingly narrow definition. A definition which actually, when you think of it, has very little to do with overall improvement in living conditions. So economic growth gets often invoked, but if you actually look at what it has meant in terms of improvement of health, access to adequate healthcare, education, there's no direct connection. So the idea of profit and citizenship is also a tricky one. So we get the gap between financial gain for some, the so-called economic growth, individual profit, and the implementation of improvements in education, health, and arts for all. And it really gets to me, because of course, after Trump got elected, they immediately paid up for the online version of The Guardian as well, in addition to already getting the little paper copy. And I'm getting very annoyed by articles that sort of have these headlines about well-being that talk about people who live in streets with trees are healthier and have a better lifestyle. And I'm thinking, who the F can live in a street with trees? Look at it. When you look at neighborhoods in Europe who actually lives in streets with trees, those people also have usually access already to far better education, far better healthcare. So there are all these kind of little statements that gets thrown out. Playing music does wonders for your child. It does. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But it costs money. It costs money in New Zealand if you want your child to really learn about music. It's not happening in school. I know. I'm a mother whose son studies music. So there are all these things that are related to appreciation and embeddedness in the humanities which have to do with hard cash, actually, with access to funds. The other one in a society that's obsessed with narrow economic growth is the obsession with vocational education. For those of you with children or grandchildren, people come home and students come home and now they say, I'm really worried about what I'm going to do, what job I'm going to have. And I sort of at first go, honey, why would you be worried about that? And then I'm thinking, why would he not be worried about that? Because times again have changed. And a lot of that sort of ferreting around finding yourself, that's gone. You know, supporting yourself and surviving, you know, buying a house in Wellington, good luck. So there are all these factors where what can sound philistine to the kind of tax-funded, educated people like me about how can you worry about that are very, very real worries for young people. So that the duty, I think, of the humanities to articulate that what we learn through the humanities has a vocational dimension, even if it's not a one-on-one dimension, even if it is not a bean-counting NCEA, if you do this, you will do this job. Because if anything, the fact that the job will still be there in 10 years is minimal. Work environment changes hugely. You need an increased adaptability, flexibility, and an articulate voice to apply, to create, to forge other professional opportunities. Okay, another problem, that's really problems related to money, problems related to size, the emphasis on quantity and problematic taxonomies. For those of us who are doing research in the humanities, we always encounter grids, forms we have to fill out, which are based on a very different taxonomy, which emphasize quantity over quality, which don't really take on board the story. Very important, storytelling, in the broader sense of the word, the story of why something matters. Not just, I will argue this and my outcomes will be 1, 2, 3, but also the significance of this meaning-making exercise. So, we deal with performance-based research funding and other assessment idea of publish and perish, outputs, all of that. So, checklists are the norm. Grant applications, word limits. There's an anecdote in Nussbaum's book where somebody didn't quite meet the word limit, so they threw in the word empirical 6 more times. That did the trick. There's a cynicism attached to that kind of form filling, which unfortunately is a reality in a lot of the situations we deal with. I wish that was not the case. At the same time, I'm a complete stickler as well as a humanities person for precision, for being articulate, concise, persuasive. Sometimes when I talk with good friends and scientists in the sciences, people who are neuroscientists, climatologists, lovely people that I have great conversations with, some of them think that I sort of spout poetry all the time or something. But no, not really. So that dialogue also indicates that we need to bridge a kind of understanding about between quantity and quality, what substance really is informed both by figures and by thinking. Unfortunately, our social media, our larger online worlds emphasize transient brevity, to be seen to do something, to gesture to something rather than offer substance. So narrow assessments geared toward narrow vocations is problematic. And I'm not using all these words that I should be using as well. You know, thinking creatively, imaginatively is absolutely crucial. So we have money, quantity, and this has to do with what actually all relates at some level to empathy and the ability to imagine somebody else's predicament or situation. Problems related to identity, interaction, and media. Frankly, I think that finding yourself is overrated. I think that being kind and appreciative of other people deserves a bit more limelight again as well. So again, their interaction, speed over substance, the kind of ingrained narcissism in the forms of social media, the selfies, the very, very tricky to gain meaningful relationships and talk about the humanities like that too. So an online life, what does that mean for citizenship, for our accountability as citizens? Kind of sort of those trigger responses. We're like back in the kind of the bad old days of the Roman Empire, you know, thumbs down, thumbs up, like, don't like, and onward it goes, you know, just moving on. So that lack of context also for accountability, trolling, bullying online, the idea of opinion, again, over significance and considered response. A lot of you, I'm sure, get barrages of email, get email all the time. I find if I don't answer an email within 2 hours, I will probably get a follow-up email that says, "Didn't you get my email?" So any response, a fast, unconsidered response, is often considered better than a thoughtful, reflective response. Tricky. Again, can the humanities flourish in that kind of speed? Maybe it's speed and identity there, you know, the kind of vast kind of propulsion into new areas all the time. Also, that sort of idea of insurance models of interaction, you know, networking all the time. Can you put that in writing? Giving somebody a compliment, is it tit for tat? How can we actually go beyond that or above it? Okay. Problems related to education. Again, very broad, just a few thoughts I had, really. The vocational anxiety of our young people. We need to be mindful of that, I think. A very justified fear of poverty. The safety nets aren't there the way they were there for me. And I need to develop the empathy to realize what that really means. Increasingly, of course, through children, homework, NCEA taxonomies, checklists that also suck in teachers who really have to produce these outputs, churn out these units all the time. Very interesting reading if you go to the website and see what learning is defined as. Emphasis on assessment versus emphasis on learning, you know, the output. What do I get if I do this? And in that context, it's very difficult to articulate, in a way, also a framework to defend and protect the humanities, but I do think we need to do that all the same. So I keep arguing for contact with students, face-to-face contact, rather than just flexible online learning, which we are definitely pushed towards. The idea of actually having to look at somebody when you tell them that you don't agree with something and find a way of saying that without hurting, without being dismissive. It takes courage. It also takes, in a way, learning. You know, it's a process. You know, it's something you learn. And then, of course, there's also the whole new library, you know. If you're used to an old library, which was like a building that had books in it that you took from shelves, well, of course, that's gone. Sources, the idea of what do you read about what, how do we find about things, has changed hugely. A big challenge also for the humanities to take responsibility for how our repositories of knowledge are managed and articulated. So, what are some of our challenges then? Very quickly, articulating what literacy is, clarifying the very real economic significance of it, integrate literacy in teaching all the time, analyzing for significance, slow reading, slow writing, reflecting on information, an interactive, respectful, safe, critical debate. The accountability which we have towards our funding kind of instances, but also the lobbying we need to do, make the flourishing of the humanities possible. And that means, and I'm very pleased we've got somebody from Zeelandia here. One of the things I love about Zeelandia is that it works with a 500-year or plus time frame. The need for a time frame beyond individual human lifespan, the long now. I think it's a very important one, that it's not just for one generation. Empathy and sympathy, and also meaning, and the understanding that perspectives and pluralism does not necessarily mean incoherence. That if it's not painting by numbers, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad or unnecessary. Non-linear problem-solving appreciation of complexity. Again, I'm sure that Carwin will enlighten us to some extent about it as well. The idea of the importance of stories, very different contexts and sources of those stories. Beyond quantification, bringing reflection to all intellectual inquiry. And also that idea of, if the humanities argues it's about what makes people happy, the arts, beautiful literature, beautiful art, we need to think about what happiness is, and that it's not just disposable pleasure. Again, that fast, the idea of a kind of contentment and happiness as different things. So we've got a bit more points that I've just tried to come up with. I've already repeated most of them, so I will wind up. What some of my friends said, I asked some of my friends, you know, what do the humanities, if you had to take one thing, what would it be? And somebody, a vet actually, she said right away, for us to question ourselves, Then a grad school friend who's now a Shakespeare professor in Finland said that some subjects may get us to the moon, it's the humanities which help us understand why we want to go there. And we can't necessarily know what the jobs will be 10 years from now, but it's the humanities that prepare us to be creative, critical thinking required to negotiate and respond to a rapidly changing environment. And that idea is very portable skill of a kind of resilience you bring. And then something I've been thinking about a lot from my own courses that I feel I will have to integrate much more clearly and specifically in the next couple of years is actually reflection on the humanities as part of courses about literature. So, for instance, teach romanticism, as I do, but also how does that relate to the humanities now? How does the situation in Calais, on the shores of Calais, respond to 1802, Wordsworth's Calais, post-French Revolution? Parallels that could be very useful. And, of course, also humanities teaches that joy and wisdom feed each other. Leave it here to make sure I'm not taking up more time. Thank you. Thank you very much.